And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday's edition, President's Day edition. And I'm joined by Bonnie Berman, of course. How are you, Bonnie?
Good. Good. Thank you. And you?
Very well. Beautiful weather. Well, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Those lines are from the eulogy of George Washington. His presidency required guile and political savvy, for he often ignored constitutional limits on presidential decisions and usurped power not addressed in the document. Joining us now is historian, journalist, and prolific author Harlow Giles Unger. He's the author of Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. And Harlow Giles Unger joins us from New York City. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
It's good to have you. Well, it's truly eye-opening to learn that our first president actually established what we call the imperial presidency, and it isn't common knowledge at all. Why do you think that is?
Well, most Americans don't know much about George Washington's presidency. They all know him as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the 8 years of the Revolutionary War, in which he participated in battles and all sorts of glorious adventures on the battlefield. His presidency did not come immediately after independence. After independence, the 13 former colonies became 13 independent states, independent nations, much like the nations of Europe. And within a few years, like the nations of Europe, they were all fighting one another, almost indeed, in several cases, at war with one another, firing shots at each other's citizens. So the new well, it wasn't a nation. The new entity was a confederation, as it was called, was falling apart and threatening to go into civil war. So George Washington helped organize a constitutional convention in which all the states agreed to cede some of their sovereignty to a federal government under the new constitution. But the constitution, the framers of the Constitution had lived under the tyranny of King George III of England for many years, and they were not about to create a president who could become a King George IV. So they gave most of the power to the House of Representatives. That's why the Constitution begins, "We the people." The House of Representatives is the only was the only federal body that was elected directly by the people. Senators were at that time were appointed by state legislators, and the president was elected by an electoral college whose members were also determined by state legislatures. So the president came to power, Washington came to power with virtually, or came to the presidency with virtually no powers. But what the Congress didn't realize at the time in framing the Constitution was that he would face many crises that they could not foresee. It was impossible for them to foresee the various crises he faced. And he faced them when Congress was in recess. Congress only met about 6 weeks of the year, in the spring and again in the fall. And most of the time they were at home and impossible to call back into session because there were no public transportation in those days. They had to travel over impassable roads and trails on horseback and carriage. So the president was alone and had to run the country.
Before he was elected president, of course, Washington was the first signer of the Constitution. He must have known how restrictive that Constitution was.
Absolutely. He was the first signer because he was president. He was the presiding officer at the Constitutional Convention. And as he put it, when he signed the Constitution, it was not exactly what he had envisioned, but it was a compromise, as everything in a democracy has to be. People today call Congress dysfunctional, but it's not. It's exactly what the framers intended. This is a nation of conflicting interests. And when you satisfy one person, you necessarily take away from somebody, you necessarily leave others dissatisfied. The government's only dysfunctional when it doesn't do what I want it to do. When it does what I want it to do, oh, the government's wonderful. That was the same thing with the Constitution. It was a compromise. Several of the states were going to walk out of the Constitutional Convention and refuse to join the Union if, for example, slavery were outlawed. Northerners wanted to outlaw slavery. The Southerners threatened to walk out. So this was a tremendous compromise, and it was, as Washington said, it was the best we could do at that time, and Article 5 left room for amendment. Try this out. If you don't like it, change it. And that holds true today. We can still, it's more difficult because we're a much larger nation, we can still change the Constitution with amendments. But in the meantime, it was a compromise, and it left him with so few powers that in order to fulfill his oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the United States and the people of the United States, he had to seize powers that were not given to him by the Constitution.
Do you think that was intended by the framers? Do you think they knew that the president would have to seize powers and violate the Constitution, or at least the letter of the Constitution?
No, they had no idea this would happen. They assumed everybody would live happily ever after, that the states would continue governing themselves as relatively sovereign states, and that the new federal government would take care of things like foreign trade, interstate trade, interstate commerce, and national defense. That's all they hoped the new federal government would do. But, they did not foresee what running the government entailed. And when they adjourned in the fall of the first Congress adjourned in the fall of 1789, it left no money in the till for Washington to run the government. And, in effect, Congress shut down the government, if you can imagine Congress ever doing such a thing.
So it's nothing new.
It's nothing new. There's nothing new in government today that didn't happen in the days of George Washington that he didn't face. Well, unlike the present president, Washington refused to allow the government to be shut down. He sent his Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, to local banks in New York City and simply borrowed money. And pledged to pay it back. President Obama apparently was afraid to declare a state of national emergency, as he should have done, and so hundreds of thousands of workers were put out of work during the shutdown. Similarly, in the spring of 1790, Indians, and they were considered foreign nations then, the Indian nations of the West attacked American settlers in the Ohio Territory, and Congress was out of session. Only Congress can declare war. Washington was not going to sit back and allow our citizens to be slaughtered. So he ordered General Anthony Wayne to draft some troops, form an army, and go to war.
Hence Fort Wayne.
That's Fort Wayne, exactly.
Well, when he went to war, was there outcry from the general public? Was there any resistance from Congress? What happened?
Well, Congress was out of session, number one. Number two, the general public really didn't know what was going on in those days. There were no communications as there are today, instant communications. It took weeks, sometimes months, before anyone saw a newspaper. There were only about a dozen newspapers in the country, and by the time they were printed and distributed, the events were long gone. So it was not a nation of instant communications the way it is today. When the Congress came back and learned what Washington had done, they more or less legalized his unconstitutional action by passing the Militia Act, which allowed him to draft the troops that he had already drafted. So But these powers that that President Washington asserted, he used them, number one, he used them wisely and only to protect American citizens, the American nation, and the American Constitution. And obviously he set precedents that other presidents have followed, and some have done as he, used these powers carefully and wisely. He issued the first presidential proclamation, first executive order with the force of law. And now the president does not have the right to do so under the Constitution. Only Congress can pass a law. That's why Congress is called a legislature. But Washington passed the first proclamation with the force of law, and Abraham Lincoln followed that precedent in issuing the Emancipation Proclamation to end slavery in this country. President George W. Bush and President Obama have used that precedent to create a network of spies that are listening to everyone's telephone calls in the country. So some presidents have used these powers wisely. Others have used them recklessly.
We're speaking with Harlow Giles Unger. He's a veteran journalist, broadcaster, educator, historian, and prolific author, and a former distinguished visiting fellow in American history at George Washington's Mount Vernon. His latest book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Bonnie, you should salute.
And you? Well, it is President's Day.
A rather old recording of course, Hail to the Chief. Of course, that music wasn't around at the time of George Washington, but it's appropriate on this holiday.
And Mr. Unger, you also talk about what he was to be called was even up to George Washington. Tell us that about that.
Well, that's why I called my book Mr. President with quotes around it. He was the first elected president in world history. There had never been an elected president, and no one knew what to call him. Some people wanted to call him His Elective Highness. And they came up with all sorts of aristocratic names for him until finally James Madison, who was a member of Congress at the time, reminded everybody that the Constitution prohibited titles in the United States and that the president had to be addressed like any other citizen of the United States, Mr. And so he was, from that point on, addressed as Mr. President. He ran into a few problems when he went into the Senate one day to present a draft of a treaty that his Secretary of War, Henry Knox, had negotiated with Native Americans in the West. And in the Senate, the presiding officer is the Vice President of the United States, but as presiding officer in the Senate, he is addressed as Mr. President. So here was Mr. President walking into the Senate, faced with the prospect of calling his own vice president Mr. President. And George Washington was not about to call anybody else that name, that title. So he solved the problem in his own unique way. He walked out and never set foot in the Senate again. And indeed, no president has ever done so. From that point on, every time the President of the United States has addressed the Congress, he has done so to a joint session of Congress in the House of Representatives, where the presiding officer is addressed as Mr. Speaker, and only the President of the United States is addressed as Mr. President.
Interesting. We're speaking with Harlow Giles Unger about his latest book, Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. If you have a question or a comment, please call us at 1-800-743-9565. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email your questions to radio@wlrn.org. Radio@wlrn.org.
Mr. Runger, let's move to Thomas Jefferson. So he's so frequently canonized by modern politicians and such, and yet he doesn't come off very well in your book.
He was an inconsistent man, would be the nicest way to describe it. But he was far from the man. He may actually have been mad at times, but no one is quite sure. He is lionized, as you say, by Americans, and not many people can really explain why. Well, they say, oh, he wrote the Declaration of Independence. Well, he didn't. The Declaration of Independence was actually drawn up by members of the Continental Congress, and he was a member of the committee and asked to turn these words into more poetic, lyrical language, which he did, borrowing from John Locke and The Rights of Man that had been written earlier in the century. So he really, John Adams called Thomas Jefferson a draftsman, not the author of the Declaration of Independence, but the draftsman who converted the language from legal language into a more poetic language. Well, what about the Louisiana Purchase? Actually, he rejected the Louisiana Purchase. He had sent James Monroe to join Ambassador Robert Livingston in Paris with the goal of buying the island of New Orleans. That was all. And Napoleon offered to sell the entire Louisiana territory. He wanted to get rid of it. And so Livingston and Monroe, on their own, made the decision to buy the entire Louisiana territory. Jefferson at first rejected it. He said it was unconstitutional for the United States to buy foreign territory, and it was. Finally, others convinced him that the population was being squeezed east of the Appalachian Mountains. We needed more territory for our population to expand and grow, and so he caved in and agreed to the Louisiana Purchase. So that left him with very, very few great accomplishments. Other than late in his life, he did found the University of Virginia, the first great secular public university in America. But Washington actually fired him as Secretary of State because he was so enamored by the French Revolution and really wanted to start a French Revolution in this country to undermine the government of George Washington. And Washington fired him. For that, there were riots. The French Revolution had turned ugly and was spilling across its borders and even affecting Americans. There were many Americans who wanted to join France in war with England. And, of course, there were many who wanted to join England in war with France because England was our greatest trading partner. So these riots grew into an enormous level where John Adams described 10,000 rioters, mobs in the streets of Philadelphia, ready to drag President Washington from his house and put him on a guillotine. So Washington then again seized powers, took law into his own hands, and passed the first presidential proclamation, the Neutrality Proclamation, which prohibited Americans from taking sides in the Franco-British War.
And so their relationship, I guess, was strained at best. I mean, if he fired him...
Oh, it was finished then. They were Washington would have nothing more to do with Jefferson. Jefferson wrote the words, "All men are created equal," and went home to Monticello, where he had 200 slaves.
Right.
He freed two slaves in the course of his life, and in his will, he freed five, all of whom were relatives of Sally Hemings, his slave mistress. Washington freed all his slaves. Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence the last words that we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, and then went home to Monticello and never fired a shot during the war. He didn't participate in the war. Other signers of the Declaration of Independence died fighting for independence. Not Jefferson. Jefferson actually, when asked to form a regiment in Charlottesville, said he can't do it. He's too busy taking care of his own interests. He was willing to pay for someone else to take his place.
So let's move
Jefferson,
on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He was far from a hero. He was far from a hero that he's that the Jefferson Foundation has been trying to build him into.
Everyone is aware of Hamilton and Burr, but actually Hamilton and Jefferson had a much bigger impact on the country. And why did they have such animosity?
Well, Hamilton believed in our revolution and was totally against slavery. He was the founder of the Abolition Society in New York, along with Aaron Burr, by the way. They were founders of the abolition movement in New York. Hamilton was the author of The Federalist, which explained and supported the Constitution and was instrumental in getting the Constitution passed. Jefferson was trying to tear this apart. Jefferson was trying to undermine the presidency and turn the our republic into a French-style revolutionary government.
We're speaking with Harlow Giles Unger. He's a journalist and prolific author. We're talking about his book, Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Tell me about the formation of the political parties, the Federalists, and then that was then termed the Democrat-Republican.
Well, again, that was Jefferson's doing.
Was it Republican-Democrat? I don't remember.
They're interchangeable. They were meaningless because he really stood for a revolution that would undermine the federal government. Washington was against political parties. In his farewell address to the nation, he warned Americans against political parties, that it would divide the nation. He wanted the nation to stand united as Americans, not as Federalists or Republicans or anything else. By the way, the Republican, the name Republican then had nothing to do with the party that was formed, that we know today, and that was formed under Abraham Lincoln. This was a radical revolutionary party that wanted to undermine the strength of the presidency. As Jefferson put it, he said he was more willing to see half the people in the world die than that the French Revolution should fail. And this was at a time when they were massacring innocent people on the guillotine without trial. So Jefferson was a dangerous fellow. And Hamilton was a loyal Washington follower. He had been. He was a hero in the Revolutionary War, of course. He was Washington's top aide during the Revolutionary War, and afterwards became Washington's appointee as Secretary of the Treasury and helped really found the financial system that we have today. He was instrumental in founding what was then called the First Bank of the United States. We now call it the Federal Reserve Board, but it basically was an imitation of the Bank of England, a central bank that the government could use as its own bank to borrow from which to borrow funds or to deposit funds.
When you just said before that some think he was mad, Thomas Jefferson, is there actually stuff written? You know, is there documentation that he may have been?
Well, the only document, real documentation we have is that from the age of 14, when his father died, he began suffering from long-lasting and just terrible, terrible headaches that today we'd probably call migraine, but they may have gone beyond migraines because he certainly did act irrationally at times. For example, in his pursuit of Aaron Burr, who was found innocent charges, trumped-up charges by Jefferson, found innocent by five different grand juries, and finally by the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Jefferson wouldn't stop his pursuit of Aaron Burr. He hated Burr for having challenged him for the presidency in 1900. In 1800 presidential elections, when Burr received the same number of electoral votes for the presidency as Jefferson, and then challenged Jefferson for the presidency in the House of Representatives. Jefferson never forgave him for daring to challenge him. So he acted irrationally at times, if not mad.
Or maybe he was just hypocritical.
Oh, that goes without saying, but that's a normal human trait. Hypocrisy, we're all guilty of that. Jefferson no more nor no less than any other human being.
We're speaking with Harlow Giles Unger, and his latest book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Harlow Giles Unger, author of Mr. President, on this President's Day. As a historian, Mr. Unger, can we just kind of get away from the topic right now? But on this President's Day, could you list your, say, top five U.S. presidents?
Well, George Washington is at the top by himself, certainly. He, to me, is the greatest president that ever lived, and the only president that acted without any political interests. He acted only in the interests of our nation. He was the greatest patriot that ever sat in the presidential chair, in my opinion. But you asked for five. I'd have to obviously have to put Abraham Lincoln as one of the five. I would say Dwight Eisenhower as another, Franklin Roosevelt as another, and Harry Truman as another. I think all four of them. For the most part, acted out of purely patriotic motives and rarely out of political motives.
I'm wondering, Jefferson objected to Washington so much, but when he became president, did he use the same powers that were set by Washington or that Washington had seized in constitutional powers?
Well, before he became president, of course, he was vice president for 4 years under John Adams, and as vice president, he was today would be called treason. He would be impeached. As vice president, he urged Kentucky and Virginia to secede from the nation if they disagreed with federal laws. Irrational man he was. As president, as I say, he at first wanted to block the Louisiana Purchase, finally caved in on that. And then the British and French were at war with each other, and both nations were seizing American ships, cargo ships, to prevent goods from reaching their enemy. Jefferson, to retaliate, and again, this is totally irrational, to retaliate, he declared a total embargo on all foreign trade. To punish the English and the French for doing this, he ended all foreign trade in this nation.
So he was punishing the nation.
Everybody.
Yeah.
He was punishing the nation. He created an economic collapse that was just unbelievable. No one could sell their goods. He said, "Well, we should now use our own raw materials and manufacture them into finished goods." Well, we didn't have a large enough population to absorb all the raw materials we were producing, and we didn't even have the facilities to turn them into manufactured goods. That's why we were such a great exporter. We were one of the great exporting nations, sending raw materials to industrialized countries like England, and then repurchasing the finished goods in exchange. So he created this tremendous economic collapse, finally backed down at the end at the urging of the Secretary of State James Madison, who had aspirations to the presidency and knew he would not be elected if they continued this embargo. So they finally ended the embargo. But he was a dreadful president, Jefferson. Nothing in comparison, none of the wisdom shown by Washington. whom he really scorned in Jefferson's famous letter to Mazzei, his next door neighbor, an Italian wine grower, a wine producer. He basically called Washington and Adams traitors to the nation. He acted irrationally a lot of the times, and that's why I suggested maybe he was mad.
Our telephone number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Email, if you're in a rush, radio@wlrn.org. First up, it's Dave in Miami. Thanks for your patience, Dave. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask your guest about the change, if you will, in the procedure for the vice presidency. As I understand it, the runner-up in the election, in the presidential election, would be to serve as the vice president. Hence, John Adams was Washington's vice president. Jefferson was Adams' vice president. When did this system change where, you know, the political candidates began selecting a running mate? And also, if he has any thoughts on Adams, Washington, and the quasi-war with the French. And I'll take your answers off the air, and love your show.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. That's a good question. And it ended during the Jefferson administration because of the Jefferson-Burr tie. Under the old rules, as you point out, the one with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the second most became vice president. Well, in 1800, Jefferson and Aaron Burr both received the same number of votes, in which case, according to the Constitution, then the decision would then be put to the House of Representatives, again, we the people, to decide the victor. And that went on for 36 ballots until finally one of the several of the states who favored Burr decided that this could produce a civil war, the Southerner Jefferson against the Northerner Burr, and so they withheld their votes and allowed the Jeffersonian votes of their state to cast the votes for Jefferson, and that's how Jefferson became president. As I say, he never forgave Burr for that, but the struggle lasted so long and threatened to leave the nation without a president that they changed the rules, and the president was the only person considered by the Electoral College.
Mr. Unger, Anne writes in, she said she believes that Thomas Jefferson is entitled to a rebuttal by someone who appreciates his greatness. We do have a caller.
Okay. This is Patty in Key West. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
How are you?
Fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you. Hello. I was listening to your report and lively discussion. Hello?
Yes, we're here. We hear you fine.
Okay, I was listening to your discussion, found it very interesting. However, everything I learned in 25 years in Virginia and learning about Thomas Jefferson contradicts many of the things you're saying. And I don't know if you have private papers to document what you're saying, but everything I've researched in the past says that Thomas Jefferson did indeed draft the first Declaration of Independence, and that he did indeed approve the Louisiana Purchase, which we can word it however you want to, but this is a man who has given us the University of Virginia and so much research and so many inventions. I would like to see you at least admit that this is a man of great stature and education, along with your incredibly, I think, one-sided comments about him overall as a politician.
Well, you just repeated what I said. He was a draft. He drafted the Declaration of Independence. He didn't author it. And
well, you can choose the verb as you want, but he's the one who drafted the first edition of it for others to look at. And
not at all. Not at all. There are several earlier drafts of it, and he simply polished up the language. And that's in every history book you can find. That's fact.
He was quite a Renaissance man, of course, though.
Absolutely. He was very well read. He had studied a great deal and was a scholar, but he was no more of a scholar than George Washington. Washington read certainly as much as Jefferson. Jefferson liked to philosophize, but he'd go one direction one day and another direction the next day. One day he's for the American Revolution, the next day he won't fire a shot in it. As I said before, and I agree with you, yes, the University of Virginia is, I think, his greatest accomplishment. And, you know, on his gravestone, he picked the things he considered his finest accomplishments, and not a word about his presidency on the gravestone. Yes, he did approve the Louisiana Purchase eventually, but he had to be talked into it. He balked at first and called it unconstitutional and was not going to approve it until members of Congress confronted him and said, the American people want this.
We're speaking with Harlow Giles Unger, and his latest book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. One more short break, and we'll be back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Harlow Giles Unger. He's a journalist, broadcaster, educator, historian, and author. And his latest book is Mr. President, George Washington, and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org.
Mr. Unger, George Washington's tremendous national stature, is that really what prevented the anarchy and having the states secede?
Yes, absolutely. He held the nation together, and he had no political ambitions and was against political parties. He did not want to run for the presidency the first time, and he had every intention of retiring at the end of his first term. Jefferson, among others, appealed to him to run again because they feared a breakup of the nation. In Jefferson's words, North and South will hang together if they have you to hang on, namely George Washington. So on that basis, he agreed to serve a second term to hold the nation together, to preserve, protect, and defend the Union, as he pledged to do in his oath. And one of the powers in my book, Mr. President, I mentioned that he seized powers in seven different areas. I call them seven pillars of executive power that created what modern scholars call the imperial presidency, with many of the powers of an emperor at times, one of which was law enforcement. The Constitution gave him no law enforcement arm, no way to enforce laws. And when a tax rebellion erupted in western Pennsylvania, the so-called Whiskey Rebellion, he had no law enforcement power, no law enforcement arm. So again, Congress was out of session. He drafted troops, and Congress agreed to support the draft. Afterwards, he drafted 13,500 men to march out to western Pennsylvania to put down this tax rebellion. And it was, at the time, it was every American's worst nightmare. He was George Washington turning tyrant, putting down tax protests, citizens' tax protests with troops, much as the British had done when he, George Washington himself, had helped lead tax protests
right.
30 years earlier.
So what was the difference?
The difference was we were represented in the American government that passed the whiskey tax. We were not represented in the British government that passed the Stamp Act. So we were represented. And as he put it, in putting down the Whiskey Rebellion, if minority, and these are Washington's words, if the minority are suffered to dictate to the majority, there can be no security for life, liberty, or property. So in putting down this minority protest, he was, in effect, enforcing the law. And this was the first time the president had ever used law enforcement powers. And again, subsequent presidents have used this power wisely. Some have used it recklessly. In the case of Dwight D. Eisenhower, he sent troops to Little Rock, Arkansas to enforce desegregation orders of the Supreme Court and ensure the right of black children to go to school with white children. On the other hand, during the Civil Rights era, many governors used forces to put down protests, peaceful protest marches by those seeking equal rights. And so executives have used these powers wisely at times and recklessly at times. Fortunately, over the years, there's always been this tug of war between the three branches of government, the legislative, judiciary, and executive. And when one branch steps over the constitutional bounds, the other two branches are there to try to rein it in and pull it in within the constitutional constraints. All three branches have been guilty and are guilty almost every day of violating the Constitution, as former Vice President Dick Cheney called the Constitution a quaint document, and he's absolutely right. None of the branches of government obey the rules of the Constitution. They're always overstepping constitutional bounds. Fortunately, the other two branches are there to pull it, to rein the transgressor back in.
You object to the use of the word dysfunctional when referring to Congress, and you go further to say that that Congress functions at all is a miracle of democracy. Do you think it could have been more effectively structured, our government?
I agree with Winston Churchill. It's probably the worst form of government ever invented, but until someone comes up with something better, it's still the best form in history. It's very inefficient. It has to be. If we're going to recognize the right of self-expression and for every group in the country to express itself, if not dominate the process, this right of free expression is essential, and it means that we're never, ever going to agree on anything unanimously. Someone's always going to disagree. Washington knew that, and the framers knew that, and intelligent people today know that. And those who give up on government by failing to vote are inviting an end to democracy. The way to preserve our democracy is to participate in it. You're not going to have your way every time. We hate snowfalls here in New York City. In Vail, Colorado, they can't wait for the next snowfall. Our interests are different. And if we're going to live together, we have to compromise.
Washington, of course, most people have the image of him as being this very kind, tolerant, wise man. But he also had quite a temper if you crossed the line.
Absolutely. But he was indeed extremely tolerant. And but personally, as commander in chief, he brooked no arguments. He had the powers of a dictator, and he could have become American dictator. He could have remained as commander in chief and become the dictator of this country and set up a new government under his direction. He did not believe in that. He believed in individual freedom. And turned it in his commissions, surrendered his commission to Congress, and went home to run his farm in Mount Vernon, Virginia.
Do you think there's anybody else that was living at that time that could have done what he did and
No.
held the nation together?
No. One of the wisest men at the Continental Congress was John Adams of Massachusetts, who tried to get to know everybody, North and South. And at the time, the Continental Congress, this was 1775, the Massachusetts militiamen, minutemen as we call them, had surrounded Boston and had the British Army under siege. So they were already at war. And the question was, were the other states going to join Massachusetts? Patrick Henry urged all the other states to join and go to war. Our brethren are already in the field, he said. Why stand we here idle? So he wanted the other Americans to go to war. Well, that was fine, but who was going to lead, if the other states joined that Massachusetts force, who was going to lead that army? And Southerners at the Continental Congress were leery about allowing that Massachusetts army was the biggest army in America. They were afraid if they won, that what's to keep them from turning on the rest of the country? And we live under a dictatorship of run by Massachusetts people. Well, John Adams sensed this and knew that the only way the Southerners would contribute troops to the Continental Army is if we had a Southerner lead them. And that was George Washington. He got to know George Washington personally at the Continental Congress. They went to church together on Sundays. They dined together and became pretty good friends. And they had common interests. Both men were farmers and loved farming. And so they grew close, and it was Adams who asked him and asked the Congress to name him Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, and that's why all the other states joined the war.
Well, it's been a very interesting hour. It's a very interesting book. Harlow Giles Unger is a journalist, broadcaster, historian, and author. His latest book, Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. Thank you so much for joining us today and for your passion.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor to be on your show.
And that wraps up this President's Day edition. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. We have more information, including author and book links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page and free audio archives of this and past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Topical Currents. And Monday, we investigate the causes and solutions. I'm sorry, Wednesday, we investigate the causes and solutions of hyper-anxious kids. And the calendar. On this day in 1564, 450 years ago, the death of artist Michelangelo in Rome at age 88. He sculpted David and the Pietà before he was 30 and worked on the resplendent Sistine Chapel for 40 years. And on this day in 1885, 129 years ago, the classic American novel Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is published by Mark Twain. It opens with the line, "You don't know me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter." And on this day in 2001, 13 years ago, the death of NASCAR icon Dale Earnhardt at the Daytona 500 during a last lap crash. He was a seven-time Winston Cup champ. If you're on holiday, we hope you have an enjoyable day. So we leave with a thought, of course, from Mark Twain, who was called by William Faulkner the father of American literature. Quote, "When a man loves cats, I am his friend and comrade without further introduction." Bonnie likes that. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.